You are listening to the IFH Podcast Network. For more amazing filmmaking and screenwriting podcasts, just go to ifhpodcastnetwork.com.
Welcome to the Bulletproof Screenwriting Podcast, episode number 148. Pika Pika. Pikachu.
Broadcasting from a dark, windowless room in Hollywood, when we really should be working on that next draft, it's the Bulletproof Screenwriting Podcast, showing you the craft and business of screenwriting while teaching you how to make your screenplay bulletproof. And here's your host, Alex Ferrari.
Welcome, welcome to another episode of the Bulletproof Screenwriting Podcast. I am your humble host, Alex Ferrari.
Now, today's show is sponsored by Bulletproof Script Coverage. Now, unlike other script coverage services, Bulletproof Script Coverage actually focuses on the kind of project you are and the goals of the project you are. So we actually break it down by three categories: micro budget, indie film market, and studio film. There's no reason to get coverage from a reader that's used to reading tentpole movies when your movie's going to be done for $100,000. And we wanted to focus on that at Bulletproof Script Coverage. Our readers have worked with Marvel Studios, CAA, WME, NBC, HBO, Disney, Scott Free, Warner Brothers, The Blacklist, and many, many more. So if you need your screenplay or TV script covered by professional readers, head on over to covermyscreenplay.com.
Today's show is also sponsored by Vidafair. In a world where filmmakers are trying to find new ways to generate revenue with their films, Vidafair lets filmmakers set their own price for a 24-hour rental of their work, which includes features, docs, and perfect for short films. This is truly a revolutionary way for filmmakers to generate revenue with their content. For more information, head over to vidafair.com.
Now, guys, today on the show, we have the writing team of Dan Hernandez and Benji Samit. And Dan and Benji are the creative masterminds behind Pokemon Detective Pikachu and the new Addams Family 2, among many other things that they've done. They've worked in television for years. They were on one of my favorite shows, One Day at a Time, 1600 Pen, and many other shows. And we get into not only what it takes to make it in writing for television and then writing in Hollywood in general, their story, their journey of getting through, breaking through, how it is to work together as a partnership, writing other people's characters like with Pikachu and the Addams Family, and what it's like running a show because now they've become showrunners of their own show, and much, much more. This is an extremely valuable episode for any screenwriters out there who want to know and get inspired by a story and also learn a little bit about the craft and how these guys are able to do what they do. So without any further ado, please enjoy my conversation with Dan Hernandez and Benji Samit. I'd like to welcome to the show Dan Hernandez and Benji, one more time. 3, 2, 1. I'd like to welcome to the show Dan Hernandez and Benji Samit. How are you guys doing?
We're great. Doing all right.
Thank you so much for coming on the show, guys. I'm so glad that we were just talking beforehand. Dan, you're the other Cuban I know in the business. people are always shocked to hear like I'm Cuban, and they're like, "You're Cuban?" It's always fascinating when I'm on set. I'll just start busting out some Spanish, and people are like, "What is going on?"
Well, yeah, it's sometimes it takes people by surprise, or you know, I think that. You know, there's more of us than I think people realize. Cuban.
Yes.
Phil Lord is Cuban.
Which, oh yeah, there's a bunch. Yeah, there's.
So there's, you know, we're kind of, we'll infiltrate slowly. That's our thing.
Listen, yeah. No matter where you are in the world, there's always, we're everywhere. Like I was in Germany, like a friend of mine was in Germany. Like they just walked by. He's like, "Is that salsa music?" And like there was a full blown salsa club right in the middle of Berlin or something like that. So we are everywhere. Infiltrating. I like that word. Infiltrating the business little by little. So guys, first and foremost, how did you two meet and how did you guys get started in the business? Cause you've been pretty much working together almost the entire time, right?
Yeah, oh yeah, we went to college together. We met in college. We went to Brown in Rhode Island, and you know, we started working on like plays and stuff in theater together, and yeah, I mean, it's, we've been together ever since. Of, you know, it's been, we graduated over 15 years ago now, and yeah, just keep writing together.
Yeah, you can't seem to shake each other.
I've tried to get rid of him, but I guess can't.
Yeah,
he's tried many times.
I actually didn't mean to wear this shirt today. I just dropped my daughter off at preschool and I just grabbed the first one, but this wasn't premeditated. But yeah, we did meet at Brown, and we just really quickly realized that we had a shared taste, I guess, for the things that we liked and the things that we didn't like. And I think so often having that taste is the first step toward a successful partnership. And so once we had that sort of foundation, it just, we started working on some theater things together. We started working on some writing projects together, and we just never stopped. We just kept going and going. So really since 2006.
Yeah.
So what was that thing that sparked it for each of you to be in this ridiculous business?
I mean, to be in this business, I grew up in LA, so I've always been sort of surrounded by it and tangentially touching it. And, you know, like my mom has written some things, my dad has worked in entertainment in various ways. And so it was always a part of my life. And, you know, I love movies, I love TV. And, you know, I think I always knew I wanted to do something with, you know, like a lot of people that grew up in LA, so many of them are just like, I want nothing to do with it. Like so many of my friends that I grew up with do not live in LA anymore. But I was just like, I love it here. I want to be here. I want to keep doing this. So, yeah, it was an easy decision for me.
My path is a little more circuitous because I'm from Fort Lauderdale, Florida originally.
Stop it. I'm from Fort Lauderdale, Florida.
Oh, really?
I was raised in the Fort Lauderdale area, and we could talk. I mean, I went. I was originally in Sunrise, but then I was born in Plantation. My parents are still. I literally just got back from Fort Lauderdale. So I'm sorry, guys. Everyone listening, I apologize. It's rare enough to see a Cuban. Rare enough to meet another Cuban in the business, let alone another one from Fort Lauderdale, Florida.
Well, not even Fort Lauderdale.
The odds are when you meet a Cuban, they're from South Florida.
I know it's very rare to even meet a Cuban from South Florida, right?
I grew up in Crawl Springs in Margate.
Okay.
So I was I say Fort Lauderdale because people don't know the deep.
Yeah.
You know, like depending on who I'm talking to, it's like, I'm from Miami.
I'm from Miami because it's like Fort Lauderdale. Isn't that where the Spring Break movies were shot? Like in 85?
Probably you had a cruise that left there once.
Yeah.
If you know Fort Lauderdale, you went on a cruise probably. But
right.
The Venice of America.
It's the Venice of America. Wow. I've never heard that.
That is true. That is their nickname. If you look on like the you know, like the city stat. Anyway.
So Dan's just shaking his head. He's like, can we just move it along?
The Fort Lauderdale podcast.
Coming from the Venice of America, I never could have imagined myself in the movie biz. I thought I would be on a glass bottom tour boat in the intercoastal or something. But I always loved writing and I always loved performing and acting. And so at Brown, I did a ton of theater, a lot of performance, a lot of writing. And I always was interested in TV writing and movie writing, but it felt like something amorphous that it didn't feel like an actual career. It felt like, intellectually, I thought to myself, well, I guess that's something that people do, but how do you even begin to pursue that? Who are the people that pursue that? And then when I met Benji, I realized anybody could do it.
Thanks, bud. That's awesome.
It was actually meeting Benji and becoming best friends with him that changed the trajectory of my life, because for Benji, who was much more familiar with
LA, because it's my hometown, like it's not the big scary place that it is for so many people.
And right.
I could sort of break down for Dan and be like, no, just come to LA. Like, we'll go. Well, we can crash at my mom's house. And
we did.
And we sure did.
So meeting Benji, who had a more practical knowledge of like, how do you even begin to pursue a profession of TV and movie writer, that really made me feel comfortable to give it a shot. And that was the beginning of that journey.
Now, you guys were involved with a project that's very dear to my heart, which is One Day at a Time, which it was sad to see it go. I was a huge fan of it. And again, going back to the whole Cuban vibe that they made him Cuban and they put him in, Echo Park, in mm-hmm. which is like, it's like the Venice of LA. But
I think it's the Venice of LA. No.
Exactly.
Echo Park.
Echo Park's the Echo Park of LA. But it was such a fun show. How did you guys get involved with that show?
Yeah. So, I mean, the showrunner of that show, co-showrunner was, Mike Royce, who, great, talented writer, big from, you know, for years and years and years. And we, our first job as staff writers was on another show that he ran, 1600 Penn. And mm-hmm. so we hit it off with him. We had a great time working with him. It was really, that was an amazing show to work on. All the writers, like, it was just such a great writer's room for a first show. And then, you know, fast forward a few years later, Mike got paired up with Gloria Calderon-Kellett, who we didn't know, but they were working on this, Cuban-American show together. And Mike, when they started staffing the show, Mike was like, I know a great Cuban that we can staff on the show.
And his friend. yes, Benji's an honorary Cuban.
Yes.
I think that, because we had a good experience with Mike on 600 Penn, he asked us if we would be interested in coming in on One Day at a Time. I was particularly interested because it felt right that, on some level for me, that I should be on the ground floor of a big Cuban show, maybe the only Cuban show that, you know, I had seen in a while. And I was really, you know, Gloria and I ended up being the only Cubans on the staff. There were other Latino people, but we were the Cubans on the staff for the first two seasons. And then in the third season, Janine Brito joined us, who's amazing. Half Cuban, half Icelandic.
How does that happen?
Pretty good. Yeah, pretty good. but for the first two seasons, it was just Gloria and me. And I felt like part of what my contribution was trying to bring verisimilitude and authenticity to the stories that we were telling. And we did realize that, and you probably know this better than anyone, is, you know, a Cuban growing up in Los Angeles or San Diego has a very different experience from a Cuban growing up in Miami or Fort Lauderdale. You know, obviously we all started in, you know, the same spot in the Caribbean, but you know, that just the diaspora has, it just, it yields different experiences. And so I think that I was sort of the East Coast representative of what that experience was. And I tried to, and you know, my, it so happens that my family, like the family I wanted at the time, is extremely liberal, which is sort of atypical. So I did feel like there was, but not all of them, but my direct family. So I felt very close to the Alvarez family in that sense, which I did think it was really interesting to write a Cuban family that was progressive and that was working on issues and really trying to like work out where they landed on a bunch of topics that were mm-hmm. tough and not always obvious to talk about. So I'm really proud of the work that we did on that show, and I was really happy. And of course, the opportunity to work with Norman Lear was a huge, what a gift that was.
So there was something, I saw every episode and I remember watching it. I'm like, my God, this is very much like a throwback to the 80s and 90s when they would do the deep episode. The episode that tackles something deep. Like, you wouldn't see that with a lot of the current day, even things in the last decade, you wouldn't see those kind of like tackling like racism and tackling like really tough things that shouldn't really be in a, in a 30-minute comedy, but you guys did. How was it like doing, like, how was it like trying to, was that like in the beginning? Like, you guys like, no, we're going to do this old school. We're gonna tackle things that aren't being tackled.
You know, I think partially it was, you know, when you have the show that's coming originally from the mind of Norman Lear, and you know, he's still there for this new version, and like that was, I mean, for decades and decades and decades, like that was such an important part of his work on TV. Like he was responsible for so many amazing sitcoms that were more than just silly jokes and gags and things, like extremely funny, but you know, actually using the medium to, you know, try and give a lesson in something and try to do some good with what we're doing. And so that was sort of a guiding principle and ethos. And it was important for Mike and Gloria as well, and all of the writers to try and carry that legacy forward and sort of do a classic, you know, multicam sitcom with a live audience that really, you know, it was like putting on a play every week, honestly. And yeah, it was just a great experience.
Yeah, using the template that Norman had established over the course of his illustrious career, and really trying to not shy away from that and not being worried that it would come off as old fashioned or something. That was important to all of us to try to capture and to try to live up to what is the modern interpretation of that. And because it was this Cuban family, to say, well, there's a bunch of stories within this mode of storytelling that we haven't seen before, because it's just different culture. It's culturally specific now in a way that we just haven't seen a lot of these stories told through that Norman Lear lens. And that was what we really tried to do. And I feel we were pretty successful most of the time.
What was you're working with obviously a living legend. What was it? What was the biggest lesson you took away from working with Norman?
It's a great question. Norman is a big believer in, if you get the right person for the role, that there's a lot of trust that needs to happen between the writers and the actors. And that's why he's pretty rigorous about his audition process. And he's pretty rigorous about, if he doesn't think that the actor has the spark of what he really is looking for, even if it's a good performer or a famous performer, he's not interested in that. He doesn't engage with that. He really is thinking about, what is the part? What am I trying to accomplish? What is that spark that I see in this performer?
Well, it's finding the actor that can transform that what's on the page to the next level, where, like, you know, you could have the best script ever, but if the actor doesn't click with, like, it's just not.
Doesn't matter.
And that may sound facile on some level, like you should get a good actor for your part. I guess what I'm trying to say is,
it's beyond talent.
It's beyond talent. Yeah. It's like an almost indescribable,
a spiritual connection to the part
that he really. Right. And I think that's why in his, you know, I was going to say the old days, but it sounds, you know, too ancient. But in the past, Norman often went to Broadway to look for performers who could carry a dramatic load as well as a comedic load. And Justina Machado was a Broadway performer. She's an amazing actress. I mean, Rita Moreno, of course, is Rita Moreno, a living legend, EGOT, you know, all of that. So, and then you have someone like Stephen Tobolowsky, who is just such a professional and such a craftsman and such a technician and so thoughtful in the way he does everything. And the whole cast, and, you know, Isabella, Marcel, like, you know, Isabella has now gone on to start her own show. So there clearly was something there. And of course, Todd Grinnell stepping into the role of Schneider, you know, that was
a huge role.
And so in order to kind of get the alchemy right, Norman really put an emphasis on chemistry and that sort of it factor that, you know, over the course of decades, he can recognize, I think, in a way that other people we'd all be so lucky to work long enough to be able to discern that in someone based on an audition, because sometimes these audition tapes, the best, you know, not all the best actors shine on a video.
Right.
You know, and so sometimes it's going beyond the audition tape itself or the performance on the audition and seeing some quality or some move or some physicality that feels right. And Norman is amazing at identifying those things. It's really something we really try to take away from working with him.
Yeah.
And Norman's still at it, man. I mean, he's got projects left and right still. He's still getting things developed. He's still getting things produced. How old is he now?
He's almost 100. I mean, he's 98 or 99. He's a genius.
Late 90s.
But he's an actual genius. I mean, that's right. The thing that you meet a lot of smart people in your life, and you meet many talented people, but the amount of actual genius level people that you encounter is pretty small, I would say, in this life. And so when you do encounter it, mm-hmm. it's like, oh, right, this is a special person. This is a person that is exceptional. There's right. no one that knows more about TV comedy that probably will ever live, I would venture to say.
Like, yeah, no, I mean, he's been through it all.
From the beginning.
Yeah, we were talking to him, and, you know, he was talking about how, like, he, when he went to college, like, he was, like, studying radio, and they heard rumors of this thing called TV that was going to come out. And then, like, so then he started doing that, and he's still doing that. And, yeah, like, it's just, talking to him is unlike anyone else we've ever
it's not
interacted with.
There's no comparable person,
because he's seen it all. Truly,
he was there. He's been there.
He's the oracle.
Yeah. But he also knew every single person that, you know, you can say, hey, Norman, tell us about, you ever meet Orson Welles? And he's like, yeah, as a matter of fact, I did meet Orson Welles, and here's my, you know, like, that
here's
that
my Orson Welles story.
I mean, and you could say that.
And he's still so sharp and remembers all of these things. And, like, yeah, he goes to work every day, and he lives for this stuff. And, like, it's really
inspiring. I just started watching the Rita Moreno documentary on Netflix the other day. Yeah. And she was just talking about, Marlon Brando. Thank you. Marlon Brando. And, like, she's like, oh, yeah, this and that and this. And you're just sitting there like, what?
us, behind the scenes at One Day at a Time is just her regaling us with stories of all that.
And Rita is also a genius. I mean, we've encountered a few performers in our time that I think are the transcendent talent is so remarkable that it's actually kind of breathtaking to see it expressed. And Rita is one of them. We were fortunate enough to work with Robin Williams briefly.
Oh, wow.
And that, even in the, you know, week or however many days it was that we worked with Robin, it was like, oh, that's why Robin Williams is Robin Williams, because what he's capable of doing is so beyond anything that we've ever seen, even on a show that wasn't ultimately a hit, but that didn't change the watching his craftsmanship, watching the way he approached a scene, watching the way he even approached a take in between take, you know.
Yeah.
So what Benji and I have tried to do throughout our career is try to take those lessons from these really, really talented people, genius level people, and take, you know, 15% of that as a lesson for ourselves and try to get that going forward and in our own work as best we can.
Now, I wanted to go back real quick. What was that breakthrough? What was that thing? Because I'm assuming you guys didn't just say, hey, we're going to start writing. And then the money just started, boatloads of money started coming in and opportunities started flying in. That's the way it works in Hollywood. You say you're a writer and then opportunities just show up, right? That's the way it works?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, not at all. It was just a whole lot of hustle. We were out here in LA, and we were sort of focusing on, at first, just like writing features. And, you know, we got, you know, a small agent to finally read one of our things, and he sent it to a few places. And we, you know, pretty soon after graduate, like in the first couple years, like we optioned a feature and we're like, oh, this is the thing. If suddenly it's going to get made. But no, that all fell apart. And, you know, and then like there was another, like we got hired to write like the straight to DVD movie that never got made.
Which is
and, you know,
really for the best.
But like this was when we're, you know, 25 and any gig sounds like a great gig. And then, you know, and so, yeah, we sort of thought like, oh, everything's happening. But then, no, nothing was happening. And so then we were like, well, let's keep doing movies, but let's also try doing TV because that's this whole other side of the industry that we love that's here. So we started writing some pilots and those started going around and eventually we started getting some attention there. But again, like it wasn't
overnight.
An overnight thing. Like even once we started getting to the point of like having showrunner meetings, like we weren't getting the jobs yet. Like we were suddenly at a place where like, oh yeah, we're doing showrunner meetings now. And you know, that went on for a while. Like we met on dozens of shows or like a dozen shows probably before we got our first staff job on 1600 Penn.
Yeah, I think that, you know, I think there were a couple of things going on. I think that we were fortunate to get a small agent when we first started out. But you also do realize why these big agencies are the big agencies and that, you know, that there is an access issue. So that is a bit of an uphill struggle. But on the other hand, our first agent did an amazing job of getting us read places we probably would not have been read. Just through hustle and through tenaciousness. And I think it helped that because I'm Cuban, we qualified for a lot of these diversity positions on these shows. And so we ended up getting read by a lot of places that I think probably wouldn't have read writers at our level otherwise, which was really great for us because people did start to see there was something there. Even if we weren't quite ready to get some of these jobs, there was enough promise that people did take the meeting with us and we did get in rooms with really high level people that we probably at a pretty young age. It still took a long time to and some luck to get that first gig, but I think it was all now in looking back on it, and I occasionally meet people who are sort of in similar situations now and looking back on it, when you have 12 showrunner meetings, that is a sign that something is right in what you're doing, even if those meetings don't ultimately end in a job. You can sort of say, okay, this is seems to be pointing the way towards eventually, hopefully someone is going to say yes. But in the moment, it felt more like, why is anyone saying yes? We keep having these near.
I'm pretty enough. Why doesn't anybody want to date me?
Yeah, it felt like, you know, on shows that were, you know, like winning Emmys the next year. And I was like, we could have won an Emmy. You know? It was disappointing at the time. But it forced us to continue to refine what we were doing. It can force us to, you know, work harder on our material because we did feel like we were knocking on the door. And because we had made the rounds and all these people, where luck played a part is I went to high school with Josh Gad, the actor, and he is a friend and he was very close. My wife went to the same high school and she actually was closer with him. He was a senior when we were freshmen. So she was great friends with him. One of my best friends was great friends with him. And when we moved out here, we were able to connect and we became friendly. And Josh said, this is before anything, Josh said, well, you know, if I ever get a TV show, I want you guys to work on it. And we said, okay.
Yeah, sure, sure. Yeah, that'd be great.
Sure.
Yeah.
And then he went to New York and he did a show called Book of Mormon. And then he got nominated for Tony, which he should have won, in my opinion. And then he came back and he had a show and he was like, hey, guys, I want you to write for my show. So that wasn't wasn't.
Just that alone wouldn't have been enough. But right. Like all of the other meetings that we had had on other shows, it got us on the, you know,
radar
on the radar of the NBC executives that were in charge of 1600 Penn. Oh, they already knew who we were. They, like it was sort of like all the stars aligning.
Right. So it was preparation. It was luck. It was hard work. It was it was timing, all of those things. And that's why I often say to younger writers or artists, no one's journey can really be replicated. It's not possible.
It cannot.
Because if you ask any writers, or, hey, how did you get your big break? You're going to hear a crazy roundabout shaggy dog tale of,
yeah,
well, I knew a guy who did a thing, and then, oh, I met a guy, or I was an assistant, and then I did, the, you know, it's just, it's not.
Everyone is so different.
Yeah.
So right, right.
That's how our story came about and how we got that first gig.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
Yeah, and for everyone listening, just because you knew Josh, that's no guarantee you would have gotten Josh. If you guys were just working at In-N-Out and Josh's like, hey, I want you guys to be a writer, that probably wouldn't have worked out. In fact,
because we knew Josh, there was actually some hesitancy.
Right.
From the showrunner and the creator, like, they didn't want necessarily to have, like, the actor's buddies, like, in the writer's room dictating what the actor should and shouldn't do.
You're right.
So we sort of had, it was kind of an uphill battle winning them over.
We learned a lesson, an important Hollywood lesson, which is that our agent at the time said, you're taking this meeting with the other creators of the show. It's just a formality. And what we learned is that anytime anyone tells you something, it's just a formality, it means it is not a formality. Teetering on the edge of disaster. And so I have a spidey sense for that phrase now. Anytime someone tells me it's a formality or it's a layup, I'm like, oh, okay, that means.
But I also think, you know, like some of the failed showrunner meetings from when we were younger gave us the tools to know how to then handle that meeting, that formality meeting, where some of the questions thrown at us, we actually were prepared for in a way that we weren't when we were 25. And so it's sort of like, yeah, looking back at it, it's like every moment of our journey, like,
helped.
There was a reason that happened, and it's.
Well, sometimes it is making a decision to learn something, you know. So we would occasionally be at the beginning of these showrunner meetings where they would ask you a question like, what would you change about the show? Or what's the worst part of the show? And I think the natural inclination, especially when you're young, is to equivocate and be like, no, it's fine. You know, no, it's not.
Well, to see, you feel like you as like a baby writer, like how are you going to tell a showrunner how to like fix their show, or, you know, what the issues are? But like they don't want to hire a baby writer that just tells them that they're right. They want to hire someone who is going to give ideas to make the show better. Yeah.
Right. And so after that happened a few times, we together made a decision that it was like, if anyone ever asks us a question, like, what is the worst part of the show, or what would you change about the show? We're going to be completely honest the next time that this comes up. And it so happens that question was one of the sort of major questions in the 1600 Pen interview. And we just were honest, and ultimately it proved to be the thing that got us the job. So that's sometimes awesome. It is sort of discerning, okay, what is there a lesson to be taken here? What did we do wrong? But when Greg Daniels and Mike Schur ask you like, hey, what's the worst part of Parks and Rec? And you're like, when you're 25, it's hard to be like, well, let me tell you, Greg Daniels and Mike Schur, here's what's, we just weren't there emotionally. Yeah. And I think that if, you know, going through that experience really prepared us for the future and helped set the.
Now, one thing I'm always fascinated about is, because I've never been in a writer's room, because I've never done television in that way. How do you break an episode? Like, what is the process in the writer's room to breaking an episode?
I mean, it varies, between show to show, showrunner to showrunner. But I would say the sort of most common way that it's done is, you know, we have big discussions. Those first few weeks of a writer's room is really just talking, like getting to know each other and our personal stories, personal stories that may relate to what the show is about, getting to know, just talking about who our characters are, this or that. And slowly through those discussions, episode ideas start to come up. We're like, oh yeah, it'd be funny if there was an episode where this happens, or, you know, like One Day at a Time. The first episode we wrote is the one where she was on hold for the entire episode.
Yeah, I remember that.
We're talking about the VA and it's like, oh, on hold. And it's like, it was just a moment of like, oh, it'd be funny to do an episode where she's on hold the whole time. And everyone's like, yeah, that sounds funny. Put it on the board. And so you sort of have like a list of ideas of episodes. And it's up to the showrunner then to be like, all right, now let's actually talk about that episode. And then it becomes more of a discussion of like, okay, well, what's going to happen in that episode? Start to arc it out in loose terms. And, you know, just with the group, slowly filling it out to the point where it's like, you sort of have an idea pretty much scene by scene what the episode is, what the act breaks are. And at that point, the writer who's been assigned to do that episode actually goes off to start writing an outline. But much of the, you know, yeah, the breaking of the story just happens in a sort of natural way with the whole group.
Yeah, and I think sometimes you may think that you've got a great idea for an episode, and then over the course of conversation, you find it evolves into something slightly tangential, or just an element of your initial idea survives or becomes the springboard toward what the episode is really about. And so you have to have a little bit of openness to changing things and not being prescriptive about.
Yeah, you can't be too attached to anything when you're going into these discussions. Like, it really is just like, let the discussion take us where it has to go. And a good showrunner can sort of, you know, find that line of, you know, too freewheeling a discussion versus like keeping some sort of shape of like where we're going, not right. Losing sight of the episode and sort of a whole freewheeling thing.
And now that we're showrunners, you know, you also have to be judicious in saying, this is really funny, but it doesn't sell out our characters, right? This right. is a really cool idea, but where do you go from there?
Right. Are there enough actual story turn beats for it to sustain an entire episode, or is this really just like
a gag?
So yeah, right. Is this a gag?
Or does it link up thematically with the other stories that you're telling? Because normally in an episode, you usually have an A story and a B story. Sometimes,
or if it's like, you know, this idea is good, it's not a whole episode. Oh, what about that other episode idea that was on the board? Maybe we can combine them together into one episode together. So like, it's, yeah, you sort of just have to stay aware of like everything that's been said in the room and, you know, be willing to steer it in certain directions if things aren't working.
And it can be quite technical, really. I mean, I think that maybe is something that people don't, it's hard to understand how technical it can be unless you're actually sitting in a room and seeing how the episodes are put together, because there are certain things that you need, you know, the inciting incident, the act breaks right. really strong, and all of the, you know, that there is a formula and you can mess with the formula, but basically the formula is the formula, and understanding sort of what is the bedrock of an episode of television that allows you to go off in different directions or to do something different or to subvert that expectation in a way that's unexpected. But the core of it really isn't that different than what Norman was doing or what
right.
they were doing in, you know, Abbott and Costello yeah. or something. Like, it yeah. really is. It's
well, yeah, especially yeah, in comedy.
It's comedy,
the especially. things that make people laugh have always been the same, and like you can you update it, you modernize it, but at the core, it's the same stuff.
Right. Yeah, you look at you know, the Three Stooges. I still crack up. I mean, anytime yeah. someone gets smacked in the head with a wrench, and there's no actual bodily harm.
Right.
It's funny. The banana yeah. slipping on a banana peel. Funny uh-huh. farts, farts. Funny.
I think there's just something innate in the human character that certain right. things amuse us. And I think also one thing that I find helpful, and maybe this is just the way that my brain works, is I couldn't tell you like the quadratic equation. I couldn't tell you the chemical bonds of sodium, but I can tell you what happened in a random episode of the Three Stooges, you know, some bit that they did, or I can tell you some random line from an obscure movie that, and so a lot of times I'll say, we need a bit like this. We need a moment like Groucho singing, "Hello, I Must Be Going." You know, we need something that captures the spirit of those things. So it's almost, there's a shorthand that I think of, which is, okay, we need something that plays the role of this comedic moment or this emotional moment, or, you know, an emotional moment within the craziness that really lands, I think, often, and I've referenced this before, but, you know, when Wayne and Garth in Wayne's World are lying on the top of Garth's car looking at the stars and Garth is whistling the Star Trek tune, it's actually a really beautiful, quiet moment within the craziness of that story. But it's actually one of the most important moments of the movie because you see their hopes and dreams of these guys. And it's not, I mean, yeah, there are jokes in it, but they're actually really speaking their truth in that moment. And so sometimes you say, okay, we need like a Wayne and Garth moment that's specific to our show, but captures the feeling and the spirit of, oh, this person is speaking their truth. They're struggling towards something that they probably aren't going to achieve. And we really want them to achieve it, even though it's unlikely. And so that those are almost like the component parts that you then try to build it. That, I don't know if everybody does it that way, but that's on my brain.
Yeah. Which is really interesting because I found that a lot of bad comedy doesn't understand that there has to be a human story underneath. Like you watch Coming to America, he really is looking for love. I mean, there's a lot of craziness that happens along the way that's super funny, but there's that thing that's driving the story where it's not just gag after gag after. Then you're basically doing Saturday Night Live. You're just doing, you know, skit, where a lot Absolutely. Of, is that fair?
Yeah, 100%. You need to, you know, have that core emotion that you can connect to as an audience member, or else, yeah, you're just watching silly stuff, which can sometimes be funny, but to sustain you for a long period of time, especially like when you're going into a movie, like you can't last hours without having something to connect to emotionally.
And I think it's something that I do think you refine over time. I think that the tendency for young comedy writers is to just focus on funny and gags and
being as outrageous as possible.
And there is value in that. But now, having done a lot of things and written a lot of things, it's much more clear that the things that sometimes it's seeing things that don't work and seeing things that do work really are illuminating. So the things that I feel that have been the most successful that we've written all have a core emotion that's very poignant or very moving or aspirational or whatever, that there is some real emotional stakes that is the best, is that just supports it allows you to be as crazy as you want to be because you care. If you don't care, then everything is just a wash. It's all at the same sort of volume.
Right. Like you look at something like Borat, and, you know, Borat was obviously very like outrageous and went over, in my opinion, might have gone over the top a little bit too much some of those scenes. But there's still that emotional thing. There's the thing that's driving Borat. Like you feel for Borat when he's trying to kidnap Pamela Anderson as his wife.
There's so much emotion and depth to Sasha's performance as Borat
amazing.
If it was an actor that was not doing that, like people would turn it off in five minutes. They'd
absolutely
be like, this is disgusting, this is terrible, this is stupid, but like you can't help but care about this guy because everything he's doing is coming from an earnest place.
Yes.
And he's trying so hard and there's a real emotional thing where you're just like, oh, like, I get what he wants. I agree with him. I want him to get that. He's just going about it in the wrong way. Like, he's not just, like, doing this stuff just to provoke reaction from
him. Real emotion forgives a lot of bad behavior. And that's, I think, been true of comedy from, you know, time immemorial. But, I mean, even something like, there's another version of it, which is, like, Kenny Powers on Eastbound and Down, mm-hmm. where he's doing really bad things. He's saying really bad things. But because Danny McBride, as a performer, he's just like an open wound. Mm-hmm. He's just so, it's so obvious that he's emotionally fragile and broken, that you see the genesis of all of the pain and all of the behaviors that are generating out of this person that is doing all this bad stuff. But you, on some level, you're like, oh, but he's not a bad person, really. He's just so insecure and so traumatized by whatever it is in his past that he is now expressing it in this way that is, of course, inappropriate and very funny. But there, you know, not every performer has that thing. And writing can help with that sometimes. But there are certain special performers who you're kind of just on their side, even when they're doing bad stuff. And so often it's because they give you a glimpse into a different, they give you a glimpse into an interiority that
humanity. Humanity
that is there, even if they couldn't express it as a character themselves. You see it, you recognize it for what it is, which is vulnerability, which is pain, which is humiliation, which is whatever. And those are really powerful emotions. And there always will be visceral emotions.
If you were to read a lot of like Danny McBride, Kenny Power, like that, those lines on paper, if you're just reading the script, you're like, I don't know about this character. Like, I don't. But then you see a performer who can translate it to the next level. And it's, so it is an interesting thing. You know, when we talk to writers that are still trying to, you know, find success, it's like, you can't always write, even though you can't always write that character. Like, you know, it sometimes it takes an actor to make that happen. And so, like, even if you see in your head, or you feel like, you know, like, I know in my head that when an actor does it this way, you'll see the emotion behind these lines, but like, these are the lines. But if it's like a spec script that is just like going out to the town, like, people cannot read it the way, with the delivery that's necessarily in your head. And so, you know, it is a complicated thing where, like, sometimes people are like, well, how come I can't write like that in my script? And then, like, this one went on to be successful. You know, but, you know, there's all these rules of what I can write. It's like, you just sort of have to, like, yeah, there are different rules for different stages of writing. And you know, when you're first starting out, like, you need to write something that a wide audience is able to read it and see what you're trying to do on paper.
And that doesn't necessarily mean you have to pander. It just means that it has to be written clearly.
Right.
I suspect that if you read the script of Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, you would be like, this is amazing. It's brilliant, even though it's really weird. But I think the reason you might feel that way on the page is because it's very clear what's happening.
Mm-hmm.
Happening is super articulated. It's super explained. You get it. It is illustrated. And the emotion that it's dealing with is universal to almost every single person has experienced that exact emotion. And so that's not to say, so that's an example of it. It is super specific, and obviously it's in his brilliant voice, Charlie Kaufman, but what he's actually writing about, what he's actually expressing, is something that anybody could understand. I wish I could just forget about this person.
Right.
And it's so visceral and it's so human that it does so much work for you, because you don't have to go far afield to imagine what that feels like. And so it sells so much of the idiosyncratic things about that movie. And then, you know, obviously you see it performed and it's even better.
Yeah. Right. And that movie is so crazy that if it didn't have that connection, that emotional thread that we could all connect to quickly, you'd be lost. Because it's a hard movie to follow, but it isn't a hard movie to follow at the same time. But if you didn't have that, you would literally be, you'd be lost.
And I think that that's where some of Charlie Kaufman's other movies, like Synecdoche, New York, you know, mm-hmm. I think is a much, I like that movie and I thought it was really cool, but it is a more heady and sort of intellectual experience that is a little bit harder to digest, I think, for someone that's not really focused on it.
And 100%, really right.
A decision to digest it, because you're kind of going with this writer, whereas even something like adaptation, it's very complex.
Oh, yeah. But
again, the heavy emotionality of that movie is actually pretty accessible.
I love that movie.
And it's really well articulated. And so that's what I think Benji means, which is like, if you are going to write something really weird, you have to let people in. Find the way that people are let in by that piece of material, and it'll really shine, I think. Yeah.
So, which brings me to Pokemon Detective Pikachu. Brilliant title.
Yes, of course.
I'll take it.
Turn of Sunshine.
Adaptation. And then let's bring it back to Pikachu. No, so when I first, like, I think...
To Eternal Sunshine that has Pokemon in it would be...
That's true.
It is.
That's true.
It is. It is the Eternal Sunshine of the Pokemon universe. There's no question.
Yeah, absolutely.
Absolutely no question.
That was our guiding principle.
So did you guys... Was that an original spec? Were you guys brought in on that? How did you guys get involved with that project?
So, you know, that's one where we had actually worked with the producers on a different movie like a year or so prior. And it's one of those things where, like, it's the movie we were doing before was a great movie. We were really excited about it. My favorite scripts that we've written. It seemed like, oh, this is going to get produced. It was gearing up. We were talking casting. And then, you know, we get a call one day like, oh, actually, the producers are leaving for another studio, so all their projects are dying, this one included. So it was like
another one.
It was the biggest disappointment of our career, and it felt like a huge failure. But when we look back now, it's like, oh no, that was a key turning point for us, because we wrote this script with these producers. They loved working with us. It was a great process. And then, you know, yeah, they took a job for another studio. Like, okay, there's a good opportunity for them. Like, you can't blame them for that. And it's unfortunate that the project died, but they liked us and they wanted to work with us again. And so a year later, when suddenly they're developing Detective Pikachu, we're now on the list of writers that they want to bring in. You know, they're sort of like, who are the biggest nerds we know? And that was that. So, like, the actual concept of Detective Pikachu, it was based off, it was actually a video game. It was, at the time we wrote the movie, the Detective Pikachu game was only available in Japan on the Nintendo DS. So, like, it wasn't even in English. We had, like, a rough translation of the game script.
Yeah.
But, they brought us in because we're nerds who knew about Pokemon. And...
I think that what was helpful for us is we were maybe a little bit too old to be in the full craze of the first generation of Pokemon. We were in high school.
We were in high school when it first came out.
We were also young enough to be totally familiar with it and to play the games and to have opinions about the world, to have Pokemon that we liked, to be pretty familiar with at least the first few generations of Pokemon. Now there's multiple generations, you know, like 1,000 Pokemon. So if you meet a little kid, they can rattle off every single one. You know, that took a little bit of training up for us.
Sure.
But at least for the original few generations, we knew them pretty well and we're familiar with them. And so I think that one advantage that we had going into that project is we had opinions. You said, you know, no, we should use this Pokemon because he's funny, or this Pokemon has more of a cinematic personality as opposed to one that maybe is cooler in design or in principle, but doesn't really have a defined voice that is going to translate to a movie.
Was the meme guy original Pokemon? The mime? Is that an original?
So Mr. Mime is a Pokemon, not a very popular Pokemon, actually.
Shocking.
because he's weird and creepy and sort of atypical of the other Pokemon. But the things that made him kind of weird and unpopular actually were exactly the things that we needed for the movie, because
right.
Mr. Mime had a way of expressing himself that some of the other Pokemon didn't. You could actually have a human conversation with Mr. Mime as opposed to...
But also, there was an element of like choosing which Pokemon were the most cinematic, like ones that we could build movie scenes
right,
around.
Right.
So when we're telling a noir detective story,
right?
You're gonna want to have an interrogation scene, and I think it was the director Rob who was like, "Wouldn't it be funny to do an interrogation scene with the mime Pokemon who can't talk?" And we were like, "Yeah." And so, then, of course, when we were writing that scene, this was us being like, all right, well, how are we going to get answers from a mime Pokemon? Well, can we mime torturing him? And it's one of the things. So that's like, I would say, of every crazy idea that we had when we were writing that movie, that was definitely one of the craziest ones. And that was when we were like, for sure they're cutting this. Like, there's no way
that mime torture
in the movie. And, not only did it stay in, it was like the trailer moment.
We
were pretty surprised. We were like, wow,
that made it all the way through every draft.
So I think that was an example of just having some familiarity, having an approach into this world that is, obviously very popular, but for people that didn't grow up with it or who aren't kids, it's how do you let those people in on this world as well? And how do you make it equally satisfying for hardcore fans, but also
right.
my mom,
newbies.
Who has no idea.
The other challenge with that was like, we had to make it satisfying for random people and the general public who didn't know anything about Pokemon, but making it satisfying for Pokemon fans was also nerve-wracking because this was a different kind of Pokemon. So like, when we set out to write it, like the Pokemon company was, pretty clear, like, in this world of Rhyme City, like there's no trainers, there's no battles, there's no Pokeballs, sort of like all of the defining characteristics of what makes a Pokemon story. So like when they were like, okay, yeah, so do Pokemon, but with no Pokeballs. And it's just like, it's almost like
right.
doing Star Wars with no Force,
no lightsabers.
No lightsabers, none of that. No Jedi, just like.
So you're kind of going,
And so.
What do we do here?
So it was a little scary when we first sat down. And we're like, do the fans actually want this? Would they, like, so many of them probably just want to see the classic Pokemon story of Ash, like, told in a movie. Like,
right.
What is this different kind of movie that we can tell? But it actually, as we were writing it, it became kind of freeing that we didn't have to, rely on decades worth of backstory and, worry about like, well, if we convey this character this way, it'll make people angry. The normal problems of adaptation didn't really
apply
because it was like, it was its own side universe where, yes, it's part of the world and like, it's all of the Pokemon creatures that people love, but able to see a different spin on it.
It was freeing ultimately, which is not something that we expected to begin with. And it was a good lesson that sometimes maybe it is better to sort of explore a pocket of the world that hasn't been explored before rather than go and tell a story that has been told over and over and over and over again that everyone has their own emotional connection to and their own expectation of how that story should be told and what's important to highlight in a story like that. And so that was a good lesson for us and something that we're going to try to take forward.
Yeah, it's kind of like, seeing the origin story of Spider-Man. I'm like, guys, we all know how Spider-Man was created. We all know how Batman was created. We don't need this anymore. Let's move it along.
Which I think is one of the reasons why Spider-Verse was such a revelation is because
Right.
Let's get weird. Let's explore. Yeah, let's Spider Ham. Yeah,
let's get Spider Ham in there.
You know, so, and I think that that's what felt so, I mean, in addition to the visuals, which are stunning, but just from a story point of view, it was, right. It was, didn't feel the need to tell that story again. It really was able to range far afield from where any other Spider-Man story had gone before. And I think that that's what made it feel so fresh. That's what made it feel so funny. To have serious Spider-Man next to Spider-Ham, it seems like it shouldn't work, but within the so conceit good. Of that film, it's perfect. It works brilliantly.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now, back to the show.
It was brilliant.
So that's a good example of, okay, let's tell a different kind of Spider-Man story. And I think that that's a good challenge for anyone setting out to adapt, you know, something that is a pre-existing piece of material or characters that we're familiar with, even if it's not IP per se, like Pokemon, Star Wars, whatever, but even if it's the Green Knight, you know, something that has existed for centuries, how do you tell that story in a way that is modern, that is fresh? And those are the stories that, you know, that there's something about the story that works to begin with, because it's still with us after hundreds of years in some of these cases, Robin Hood. Mm-hmm. So now it's, okay, what do we do with this thing? How do we explore something that hasn't been explored before? And those are exciting moments as a screenwriter, I think.
Now, did you work with Ryan Reynolds? Was he involved at all in the writing process at all? Because I know he was in Deadpool a whole bunch.
Yeah, so he, at the stage where we were writing at the very beginning, he wasn't involved. Like, we weren't even writing for his voice. Like, we were just sort of creating this character and writing the movie. And, you know, it was after they had that final script and they brought him on board. Like, yeah, I mean, I think, you know, Ryan goes into the recording booth and he's so brilliantly funny that
I saw it.
Lines change. And so, like, you know, we're watching the movie and we're like, we didn't write that joke, but I love it. So
yeah. I think that when you work with Ryan and someone who is so quick and so funny and has a great writing voice himself, you know, he's able to come up with this material that really works for himself. And not every actor is able to to do that, as you can imagine. But but he is. He's able to say, I'm going to try this, or I'm going to try some. Yeah, I don't know. Just
he knows
what
works.
What works for him, and the kind of things that he thinks are funny, which so happens that most people just dig it. And so we were really fortunate. Made us look good a lot of the time when he would say something really funny, and we're like, we didn't write that, but
we'll take credit.
We're happy to take credit. but I think, you know, the part that I am proud about is that we wrote a character that he really liked, and that he felt like he could, the foundation was there so that he could then run with it and do his thing, which is what you want.
And coming from the world of TV where everything is collaborative, like, we don't have that sort of same preciousness that maybe other feature writers might have of, like, that's not the exact word I had. We're like, you know, on One Day at a Time or any other sitcom we've written on, like, we've got jokes in every episode, not just the ones with our names on them. And, you know, the ones with our names on them, you know, everyone else from the writing staff has jokes in there too. It's like, it is a collaborative thing, and we like that.
It's been useful to have that foundation in writing movies, because you just have to be flexible, and you have to not be like, no, it's gotta be like,
especially these big sort of IP driven movies. Like, there are a lot of cooks in the kitchen for that. Like, that's just the nature
of
it. You know, these are corporate owned properties. Like, there's they're bigger than just you, the writer of the movie. So, you know,
how do you navigate within that? How do you try to make everybody
happy,
feel confident that you know what you're doing? That you have an opinion. You know, I think it's easy sometimes in those situations to say whatever you guys want, but sometimes it's actually more beneficial to a project as the writer to say, Well, hold on. Let's slow down for a second. Here's why we decided to do it this way. And to have a really good thought out reason. And sometimes people go, oh, you know what? You're right. Or, oh, you're right. I didn't think about it that way. And so these big projects gain a momentum of their own. And sometimes it's hard to see the forest for the trees. But we were fortunate that Pokemon ended up turning out as good as it did because we love it.
And then you also jumped on another big property, which was Addams Family, which is a huge, you know, like it's been around forever. And so many people know, I mean, everyone knows the song. Everybody knows the characters. By the way, my daughter's obsessed with Addams Family right now. Like they're obsessed with it. And I told them, like, you know, there's like, there's live action movies. Just like, they're like, what? They're like, there's live action. I'm like, yes, we'll get the live actions as well. How do you that property, those stories, I mean, have been told again and again and told well in other films. I had Barry Sonnenfeld on the show a while ago, and we talked about
he knows
how he had to deal with Addams Family, the first one. So how did you guys approach, you know, telling the story of the second animated version?
Well, I think that similarly to Pokemon, you know, we had a real sense of these characters.
Sure.
And I think that in the case of the Addams Family, and a deep affection and love for those characters, and I think because of those live action movies and then going back and watching the old shows and reading the old strips even. But I think that when you have characters like the Addams Family, unlike a Pikachu, whose personality can only be so defined,
right?
The Addams Family, each of them is extremely defined and have been for decades.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, it made the writing, like, it's rare to
have something so structured.
Starting a script where you instantly on day one know exactly the voice of every one of your characters and like what kind of jokes they would say, like what's a good Gomez joke, what's a good Morticia joke. We didn't have to create any of that. Like, that is set in stone. We know people, you know. People know and love these characters. We just have to do justice to those voices.
Right. So I think that, you know, the Addams Family 2 and the animated series is a little bit different than the live action because I think they are aimed more at kids. So it's then saying, okay, well, what's a story that honors the Addams Family tradition and isn't pandering and isn't dumbing down, but also is something that is emotionally accessible to younger people that they can really hook into and understand. And so then the question becomes, okay, yes, it's great that these characters are so defined, but we've also seen them in a lot of different circumstances over the years. And so it's like, what's left that we haven't seen them do a million times before or that we haven't explored fully? In this case, one of the premises of the movie is Wednesday actually a member of an Addams Family by blood, by birth, or not? And that was so it then became a question of, well, what makes an Addams? What is an Addams? What is it?
That's a cool
physical thing? Is it a birth thing? Is it an attitude thing? Is it nature? Is it nurture? Both of which I think the Addams Family would not like. So that was the genesis of where that story idea came from. And then, like Benji said, the characters are so defined. That part for us was relatively easy because we felt pretty confident to write in the voices of these characters. Now, not everyone likes doing that, right?
Right. They want to create their own thing, right?
Right. They want to create their own thing. And it just so happens that we actually enjoy doing both. Mm-hmm. Sometimes we enjoy creating original new characters, and sometimes it's really fun to take somebody else's character for a spin and get to try out some things that you wouldn't normally, you know. I never thought I would get to write Gomez jokes. Gomez is one of my favorite characters in all of anything. So it was a lot of fun in that respect. And it also felt like it didn't really feel like work because so much of the work had been done for us. Really, the bulk of the work was in the plotting and in the structure and the execution of that plot, as opposed to how is Gomez going to act here? What's a funny professor bit?
Right.
And then, you know, because this is animated, you can expand the range of what is possible for these characters physically. In
cousin it, yeah, like cousin it,
Fester slowly transforming into an octopus creature is like, it's one of those things where it's like in live action you would never really do that,
but
in animation it's like, let's go for it.
Do that as long as it feels consistent with the Fester that we know, and in this case especially that, you know, that the kids are now familiar with. And we've been really fortunate that kids love they love the movie and the first one.
They love it.
That's rewarding for us to get to hear from people. My kid has already watched it 5 times.
My daughter is obsessed with Wednesday. Like obsessed with Wednesday. She's like Wednesday's the coolest character ever.
I have a 4-year-old daughter who just the other day she watched the movie for the first time and she loved it and she loved Wednesday and like, yeah, I mean, for me, that was exciting because it was like the first thing that we've written that my kid could watch.
Right.
That was thrilling in its own way. she was very proud. It was nice.
So that's how I would say that's how we approach something like Addams Family, which is, you know, every project has its own idiosyncratic element. And you kind of have to be adaptable and tailor kind of what is required of you as a writer to what the project is and what the ultimate goal of each of those projects is.
Now, and obviously you were listening to the MC Hammer song on loop while you were writing this, right? The Addams Family.
We did not listen to it.
Now, I'm going to ask you a few questions I ask all of my guests. What is the lesson that took you the longest to learn, whether in the film industry or in life?
I would say that like that it was sort of what I was talking about earlier of like the moments of defeat and the low points,
right?
In hindsight, are actually every single thing is a path towards victory in the end, or, you know, it is a stepping stone. Like you look at it as like, this is the end, but really in hindsight, you will see that like, that could have been a key pivotal moment, and to sort of like allow yourself to remain open to that possibility, even and try when we're in the moment now. I think we're now a little better because we now have this career that we can look back on of this happening again and again, of like when a bad thing happens, we can now sometimes say, well, like maybe it's for the best because we made a good relationship here and we can still turn it into like, it's not the end. It's not as like doom and gloom as it maybe was early on in our career.
Yeah. It's great advice. What advice would you give a screenwriter trying to break into TV or into the film business today?
I think, you know, like I said, there isn't one path that is the path. So you should disabuse yourself of the idea that you can replicate anyone's journey or that what you're doing is the way you have to do things or the way someone else did it. It's just not true. I think that the part of it that will always remain true is having something that you can, a piece of material that you could share with people where you say, where you reach a point where you can say, if someone doesn't like this, I'm okay with that because I feel like I executed what I wanted to execute the best I could possibly execute it, knowing 50% or more of people who read anything that you write, including us, will just not like it for whatever reason. So you have to get comfortable with rejection. You have to get comfortable with judgment of things sometimes that are very personal to you. But my opinion is that if you write material that really is unique to your point of view, whether that is a personal, ethnic point of view, cultural, societal, class, whatever, some amazing experience that you had, some point of view or philosophy that you have that is unique, like Larry David, you know, certainly has a you. Right? So when you can do something, when what you have written really is a calling card into the shorthand of your being and your personality and the way that you look at things, that's the material that inevitably is noticed and is passed around and is well received. And so don't chase trends, don't chase things like you think that you ought to do.
I mean, right, look at
Fleabag, right? Like that was a play that she wrote, but it would be hard to say, okay, I'm going to write a Fleabag now. You know, that's not, I don't think it really works like that. I think that probably she had something inside of her that she needed to express, and through, you know, because she's brilliant, you know, like that, it, you know, it wound its way until suddenly she is Phoebe Waller-Bridge, you know, right? And Fleabag is Fleabag. But everyone, I think, has that thing inside of them that is extremely personal and extremely unique. That doesn't mean it needs to be super serious or heavy. It just has to be from you and you alone. And once you have that piece of material, then you can, and it takes time, right? You may not hit on that piece of material the first time out or the fifth time out or the 10th time out. But if you make a little progress each time, now you're able to share that material with others, and the feedback that you're going to get is going to start to get better and better and better. And as the feedback gets better and better and better, the range of people who will read it and the opportunities that are going to come your way are going to just expand. And so I would focus on that first and foremost, and then start to strategize about the nitty gritty of, okay, how do I network? How do I get an agent?
Right,
That's all good and important, but it doesn't really mean that much, and it's not as high yield unless you have that entry ticket that is your script, that is
your voice. Yeah, your voice.
You know, and I think again, it's like, write a brilliant script. It's like, yes, but I think it's actually a little more nuanced than that. I wouldn't say the script that Benji and I wrote that got noticed by some of these people was a brilliant script. Certainly not by our current standards, but what it was a true script to who we were in the time that we wrote it. And I think that came through in such a way that they were like, okay, maybe this script itself isn't perfect.
We were not trying to emulate anything else. We were just writing ourselves on the page. And I think that's what excited people and sort of.
So there's a difference between like a perfect script and a script that is getting across a point of view and a person, especially in television. It's like, if I read something that's not perfect, but is really interesting, or I think that the brain behind it is really interesting, 9 times out of 10, I'll say, let's talk to this person. Let's see what they're about. Because especially when I'm running a show, I don't need everyone to be the best at writing the show that I'm in charge of. I don't need their own personal material to be so perfectly brilliant that, you know, there's no criticism. But what I do need is to say, I think this person thinks in the right way. They have the right prerequisite amount of, you know, technical writing ability. And if they're a cool person and I like how they, you know, they are, like if we vibe, I can teach them how to write how I want them to write.
Sure.
And so I think that would be my advice.
And last question, kind of like rapid fire, 3 screenplays that every screenwriter should read. Or 3 pilots that every screenwriter should read.
That's a good question. Three screenplays or pilots that everyone should read. Okay. If you're a dramatic writer, you should read the pilot of The Shield.
Yep.
It's unbelievably good, and it's just a special script. It just does some things that are shocking, and even to people who watch it now, it's unexpected, and it's just not what you think it's going to be. So that would be one for drama. Do you have one?
One for comedy. Trying to think of
the pilot of, I mean, I'm just thinking of scripts that I think are brilliant. You may be surprised. The pilot of Glee is exceptional. It's truly, it's nearly flawless, actually. just in the way that it uses voiceover and the way that it uses the integration of the songs, and the characters are clearly defined and a lot of characters in a period of time. It's
very funny.
It's really funny.
Yeah.
In many ways, the high watermark of that show, it's for me at least, it's really damn good. So that's a pilot that jumps out at me as a really something to study and to like just dig into what makes this thing work.
Mm-hmm.
And then as a movie, you really can't go wrong with Wayne's World. It's really, really, really special. Yes, there are amazing performers at the heart of it, but if you really strip it down to its basic components, it is an underdog story
mm-hmm.
that is perfectly articulated, and every step of the way feels truthful and it feels real too. And the stakes, while in the wider sense of the world are pretty low, to them it means everything. And sometimes that's a hard, actually a pretty hard mark to hit, which is like, they're going to lose their public access show. You know?
That's their world. That's everything they have.
But for Wayne and Garth, that is the world.
Yeah.
That's their world. That is the one area in which they feel special.
Right.
The one area in which they are anything, coming from Aurora, coming from this town where there's not much in front of them. But what they do have is Wayne's World. And when you try to take that away from them, it is an existential crisis. And you do understand, like, what are Wayne and Garth without Wayne's World? And so there's a lot to really study. And there's all kinds of craziness in the movie, but the core emotions, the friendship at the heart of that movie, the idea of small town, the idea of having a dream, all of it is in that screenplay. And I just think it's remarkably good.
Well, guys, thank you so much for your time and thank you for being on the show. It has been an absolute pleasure talking to you. Thank you for making Adam's Family. Thank you for making Detective Pikachu. My daughters are very happy about that. Continued success to both of you guys and keep doing what you're doing, guys. We appreciate you.
Well, thank you so much. We really appreciate it. It was fun talking to you.
Really appreciate it.
I want to thank Dan and Benji for coming on the show and dropping their knowledge bombs on the tribe. Thank you again so much, guys. If you want to get links to anything we spoke about in this episode, head over to the show notes at bulletproofscreenwriting.tv/148. And if you haven't already, please head over to screenwritingpodcast.com, subscribe, and leave a good review for the show. It truly helps us out a lot. Thank you again so much for listening, guys. As always, keep on writing, no matter what. I'll talk to you soon.
Thanks for listening to the Bulletproof Screenwriting Podcast at bulletproofscreenwriting.tv.